And welcome to the Blue Jays Plus Podcast. I am Ewan Ross in Prince George, British Columbia, and you are?
Gideon Turk in Toronto, Ontario.
So this week we will be discussing Casper Wells's roster moves, Brad Lincoln's strange situation with the team, Alex Anthopoulos' roster management, Munenori Kawasaki, and panicking time, when is it appropriate? Vernon Wells, what the hell? Our minor league player of the week, an interview with Baseball Prospectus' Harry Pavlidis, and a rant that I'm going to do on some Boston-related things. So, jumping right in, I want to say Monday or Sunday, the Blue Jays designated for assignment the recently acquired Casper Wells, and I don't understand. I don't know where to begin here, because we just acquired him, and I thought that it was a very good move. I thought he fit our team needs very well. He could platoon with Colby Rasmus and with Adam Lind. But before even stepping on the field with the Blue Jays, he was kicked off the team, or at least likely, because I don't think he's going to clear waivers. So start with you, Gideon. What are your thoughts on this?
It makes no sense, especially with when Batista got injured. Then you're down to a two-man bench, I think it was. Maybe it was a three-man bench. But anyways, the eight-man bullpen is idiotic, and Rasmus cannot hit lefties. We saw it this week. He went, I think it was 0-for-4 against a lefty.
Yeah.
And it makes no sense. It's why DFA him?
Yeah, I didn't understand it, because while I really like Mark DeRosa on this team, even if he hasn't been off to a very good start. He offers you nice flexibility on the team, but I'm pretty sure he would not have been claimed had he been designated for assignment.
Yeah.
So they could have sent him down, kept Wells, especially with Bautista being injured, it would have given you more flexibility. And especially given that Sergio Santos was put on the DL, I believe, the day after they designated Wells. So, I don't know. I'm confused.
Yeah. And with Wells' departure, we saw the addition of Ramon Ortiz to the team.
Yes, what? We did. Any thoughts on the lovely Ramon Ortiz?
I have no thoughts whatsoever.
I mean, Ramon Ortiz was a guy when he was at the Angels in his prime, you know, posted, you know, a two-win season, another one damn near, and he was fine. But that was over a decade ago before he's been anything but good. Since then, he's gone to the Reds, the Nationals, the Giants, the Mets, the Rays, the Dodgers, the Cubs, the Yankees. Most of these teams, he did not get out of AAA. He wasn't in the majors for the past, at least last year. So, you know, I don't understand.
I'm at a loss for words when it comes to him on the team. Last time he was relatively useful was when the Leafs made the playoffs. Oh, I guess I can't, guess I can't use that anymore.
No, you can't after tonight, which is sad because screw the Leafs.
I hate the Leafs. Now I'm going to have to hear from all my friends that the Leafs made the playoffs before the Jays.
Oh, good for them, because, you know, half the teams in that league make the playoffs, so
53%.
The only possible explanation I can see is that they thought they needed a long man in the bullpen, and Ortiz is a starter, so he has, you know, he's been a starter for essentially his entire career, with almost 80% of his appearances coming as a starter. But, you know, last time he was in the majors was with the Cubs, where he posted a almost ERA of 5 and a negative WAR. Year before that with the Dodgers, an ERA over 6 and another negative WAR. You know, I don't get it.
Especially when Brad Lincoln is just sitting there down in AAA.
You are getting better at this, buddy. Yeah, Brad Lincoln, who was acquired in the Travis Snyder trade last year. And I understand that after he arrived here, he was not very good, posted a negative WAR with us by Fangraphs. But this is a guy who has one of the nastiest curveballs in the majors. Was really good for the Cubs before being acquired last year. And in his six innings, admittedly an incredibly small sample size in AAA, he has a strikeout per nine of 12, which is a strikeout percentage over 30%.
And basically the only good thing about him so far this year.
Yeah, his ERA is inflated in AAA, but that's because of a
ridiculously small sample size.
Yeah, I mean, he's given up 3 home runs per 9 innings, which is really, really bad. But that doesn't seem sustainable at all. That seems like a complete aberration. Whereas him striking out a guy an inning is what he did last year. So he also has a history of being a starter, so he could theoretically be a long man in the bullpen, along with Ishmael Rogers, sorry. Well, I'm back into my 90s-isms again. But it seems like Lincoln should have a place on this team. Especially if we're shitbags like Ramon Ortiz.
Especially when Travis Snyder is killing it in Pittsburgh. Double H really trying to make Brad Lincoln look good in front of the fans.
That's a bad reason to call him up. But I agree. You know, he was acquired for a reason. He was acquired because he had upside, being a former top five pick. And I don't see how that upside has disappeared.
Yeah, all of his numbers last year spiked dramatically, way over his career norms. Home run for fastball, ground ball percentage, left on base percentage dropped. There's really no reason why you should take this 28.2 innings that he pitched for us last year as to define what he really is. And I think that's what the Jays are doing right now. They don't like what they saw in him last year, and they don't like what they saw him in spring training. They don't like what they're seeing him in now.
Well, it's kind of ridiculous. I could understand that if they weren't deciding to take a 40-year-old starting pitcher who hasn't been good since I was in high school over him. I mean, Ramon Ortiz, like, the other thing I don't get about Ramon Ortiz is, if they believed in Ramon Ortiz, why did they call Dave Bush up earlier in the year? You know, like, these guys are the same guy, effectively. Like, Dave Bush has been better more recently than Ramon Ortiz has. So it's just very, very, very strange.
Yeah, to say the least.
So, in a related vein, you wanted to talk about Alex Anthopoulos' roster management. I don't really know where you're going here, so take a swing.
It's basically that 25th man. I mean, we've seen Bush, we've seen Ortiz, DeRosa, and last year he seemed to like the 8-man bullpen. We don't know really if it was Farrell, but then we saw him this year again with it. It's kind of strange. Like, he's very good at trading, he's good at drafting from what we've seen, which his free agency hasn't been, well, he doesn't,
I don't
really sign with him.
I like the Cabrera move, I like the Asturias move.
But that's basically it.
Yeah, if you don't want to use free agency, I'm okay with that.
But then, like, with this 24th, 25th guy, it's has not been the best. And you could make the case that Mark DeRosa, there isn't much need for him on this team. Maybe you want to call up somebody like Andy LaRoche instead of him.
I don't think so. I'm not an Andy LaRoche fan, personally. But if you didn't like Mark DeRosa, that should be Casper Wells' spot.
Exactly. Why are you DFAing? Casper Wells can affect this team. Adam Lind and Colby Rasmus cannot hit lefties. You need somebody to go in for them. Why do you fake Casper Wells for Ramon Ortiz?
Yeah, I don't necessarily have an issue with rotating that 25th man, especially because I really like what he's doing with the waiver wire. He is grabbing as much talent as possible. As MLB trade rumors came out with last week, they had a listing of all the waiver claims that have been done in the majors. And the Blue Jays have made more claims than, I believe it was almost half of the rest of the teams in the league. At least like 6 or 8 teams at the very least.
Yeah, they were involved in 26.3% or something like that of all waiver claims.
Yeah, and there are teams who have made none, and there are eight teams who have made two. And I like that. He's just grabbing talent and seeing how many he can sneak down. He's done it with Edgar Gonzalez and a few other guys who are so memorable I don't even can't even think of their names right now.
I like that. I'm not debating that, but I don't like what he did with the Wells and Ortiz and with Lincoln just sitting there.
It's curious because you think you might have some upside, especially with this team needing a bit of a kickstart. I don't want guys who are going to be league average. I want guys who might be a little better than that.
Yeah.
And I think Lincoln and Wells both have the potential to be better than that.
Yeah, Wells has nice power and he can hit lefties, right?
And he can defend. After seeing Bonifacio in center, the White Sox, where he just butchered a ball in center field that was over his head, and he just took a brutal route on the ball.
Not that Rasmus would have gotten to it either, but...
No, he wouldn't have. But at least Rasmus would have been slow getting to it, as opposed to Bonifacio, who went left, and then right, and then left. Kind of sick of Emilio Bonifacio at this point.
Yeah. Is he back on the bench now? The Asturias at second and Batista in right?
That looks to be the setup. He hasn't started the last couple games, but I like him as a bench player. He offers nice versatility, but I just think Castro-Wells was a defensive outfielder that we could have used, because Davis, despite what Mike Wilner might tell you, is not a good defender.
Nor are Jose Bautista, Colby Rasmus, or Melky Cabrera.
No, they're not.
And your other options in the outfield, Bonifacio and DeRosa, are not good at all either.
I don't think we see DeRosa in the outfield unless it's an emergency. The other thing that I really noticed this week was looking at the Fangraphs leaderboard, how many of the Blue Jays were in the very last page. It was DeRosa, it was Asturias. One second here, let me bring this up. Vamping. Yeah, you got Asturias, who is the fourth worst player in the majors, because he has been, by user, the very worst fielder in the majors, which doesn't seem believable. Mark DeRosa is the second worst defender in the majors at -3.5 runs. He's on this back page. Someone else has escaped the back page in the past. But it's like there's just so much bad on this team right now, and it's getting very, very, very frustrating to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bonifacio's just escaped it. Adam Lind is just off the page. Melky Cabrera is just off the page. It's pretty ugly. Very ugly. So, to our next topic, which is a much happier topic, because he's been one of the most fun players to watch in a Blue Jays uniform in quite a while, and that is Munenori Kawasaki. And he is incredibly fun. Not only has he been quite good with an on-base percentage of over 360, a slugging percentage shockingly over 350, and he's been pretty decent at shortstop from what I've seen.
Yeah, and he's been taking pitches. I think he's averaging over 5 in at bat, which is honestly, for my number 9 hitter, that's all I really want.
An 18% walk rate to a 4.5% strikeout percentage. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Was it last week we discussed looking for fill-ins at shortstop?
Yep.
We're not going to find a better fill-in than Kawasaki.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that is how you pronounce it. Most people are getting it wrong these days, but that's in fact correct.
I thought it was Kawasaki.
No. I'm right on this one.
Okay. Yeah, he's an awesome guy. I was at the game on Tuesday, and he was signing, so I went down. And he's like talking to all the fans. He's like, you know why I don't speak English? It's because I'm Japanese. And he's just fooling around. He's lobby-staying. He's bowing. It's awesome.
It is very awesome. I mean, I've never seen a player who is hitting 230 have more jerseys in the field than I saw yesterday. You know, you got the jerseys going on. I saw at least like 5 or 6 Kawasaki jerseys. You know, I saw some people comparing him to John McDonald, but John McDonald was never this much fun.
Not at all.
No. You know, he's so much fun, and while the team is struggling, we need as much fun as we can get out of this club because it takes our mind off how crappy we've been.
Yeah, especially with the errors and the defense. The defense is that really blows your self-esteem and your confidence, but guys like Kawasaki and guys like Laurie, Bonifacio Reyes, they bring it up.
I don't want to talk about Bonifacio's defense. Just ignore that for now. But yeah, that speaking of how bad we've been, I wanna just look at when is, like, we all know it's small sample size, blah blah blah, it's still April. But when is it truly time to panic with this team? You got any opinions on that?
I think the end of May, early June. When do you
think? Yeah, I'm thinking middle of May. If it's middle of May and we're still in last place.
How far in last place? Like two games under 500?
If we're five games back of second or third of a realistic playoff spot, I'm going to be panicking. Yeah. And it'll really depend on how we're doing it. If we're doing it with, you know, some of the guys starting to come around, sure. But at the moment, the only team in the American League who has a worse run differential than us is the Houston Astros.
Which don't count as a team, so we are in last.
Oh, sorry?
Which don't count as a team, so we are in last.
Yeah, and I don't think that includes today, so we might actually be in last. And
look, the Tigers and the Athletics were under 500, I think, come July 1st last year. Which I'm not saying don't panic until July, but if they're not so far out, it's not a bad thing.
It isn't. And if we're getting Reyes back, and because we did get seemingly some good news on him, it looks like he might be at the short end of his return timetable. Which is good. We need all the good news we can get. But and we have seen at least the starting pitching taking steps in the right direction. Dickey looked great in his last start. Johnson looked even better. And if the starting pitching is coming around, I have faith that this team is going to hit. So, you know, maybe we're seeing some signs that things are turning around. But I don't know. It's getting awfully discouraging.
This next, I think, like 30... Well, I guess now it's down to 33 games. 28 out of our next 33 games, I think, are against AL East opponents.
Gotta make in a
key part of the schedule.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
we go Orioles, Yankees. Well, we finish this Yankee series, then we go Orioles, Yankees, Red Sox, Mariners, Rays, Red Sox, Giants, Yankees, Rays, Orioles.
Wow. That is so
until May 27th when we face the Braves. We have two series against non-AL East opponents, the two-gamer against the Giants in mid-May and the three-game series against the Mariners first weekend of May.
Hey, the Jays have TBS games coming up. Wow, nationally broadcast games. Anyway, yeah, the big downside there is if they lose, if they continue this stretch against the entirely AL East schedule, we could get buried.
Yeah, it could be a problem.
But at the same time, I'm choosing to still ignore the idiots who are the nihilist Toronto sports fans who are used to everything going wrong and still trying to look things on the upside. Things are going to get better.
Hopefully the Jays will take the back seat to the Leafs for a couple of months now.
Oh, don't say that. Like, the Leafs are going to be out of the playoffs in the first round, and everyone's going to be panicking, and then by that time, the Jays will be back in first place, and we'll forget that anything bad happened. So, from that very depressing point, we're going to go to an even more depressing point, and that is Vernon Wells, what the hell. Vernon Wells came in with the Yankees this weekend, and abused the Blue Jays in the first two games of the year. of the series, at least. You know, Vernon Wells currently has a 370 on base percentage and a 580 slugging percentage. Those are the best lines of his career in any season.
Vernon Wells. Of course,
it's only 14 games, but it's really sad.
If Vernon Wells was on the Blue Jays, he would lead them in WAR, according to Fangraphs.
Of course he would.
Or tie them with Colby Rasmus.
But if Vernon Wells was on the Blue Jays, he would be terrible, so...
Exactly.
I just don't get it. I mean, I thought Vernon Wells was done. Like, stick a fork in him, absolutely toast.
Yeah, he has not been good. He hasn't been playable the past 2 years.
No, he had... I want to say he was... Like, his season in 2011 was the worst on-base percentage ever by a corner outfielder who got enough at-bats. And now he goes to New York and puts on those magical pinstripes, and he's great all of a sudden.
Just like Kevin Youkilis and Travis Hafner.
Yeah, Kevin Youkilis. They're playing Kevin Youkilis at third base still, though, and that's not going to go all the way. He was brutal on Friday night defensively. But it didn't matter because the Yankees are magical and they still managed to stupidly beat us.
I hate the Yankees.
James.
We need one of our Laugh at the Yankees segments soon. I really hope they give us the honor of doing that eventually.
Yeah, I you know, the Red Sox are in first place. The Yankees, I think, are in second place. And no, just go away. Why can't you be bad? So discouraging. You know, who would have thought that the Jays are in last and the Rays are in second last in the division?
That's why I'm not concerned, because the Rays are in second last.
It's true. And, you know, yeah, I don't see this lasting unless Boston takes this magical inspiration from bombings and goes to the series because of it, because we all love our false narratives.
The Rockies are 13-4, so we have to beware of sample sizes.
Very true, very true. It's just, it's getting tougher and tougher to keep repeating that mantra. Mm-hmm. Anyway, to our prospect of the week, or our minor leaguer of the week, we are going to talk about Moises Sierra. I'm going to let you take the lead on this one.
Moises Sierra has had quite the week. Was he batting like 520? Wait, I just lost his page. You take over for a second.
He is for the season, he is batting .395 with a .438 slugging percentage and a .438 on base percentage and a .512 slugging percentage. So he is absolutely destroying the ball.
And over the last 10 games, he's batting .526 with, oh wait, no, that's his on base percentage. He's batting .438 with an on base percentage of .526 and a slugging percentage of .563. Capped off on, was it Thursday?
Yeah, that game was a fun game.
When the Bison scored like 27 runs or something like that, new International League record. When Moises Sierra went 6-for-6, which, that's crazy. Scoring 5 runs with an OPS of 2.5 in that game.
Yeah, awesome. That game was a game for the ages by the looks of it.
I turned that on MILB.TV. I think it was in the second inning and it was 5-0.
Oh, you watched that game?
Or no, I watched a few at-bats, and then I had to go to class. But, oh, it was crazy. I was following it on Twitter during class. It was amazing.
I was also quite impressed with him, because he was the starting right fielder for the Dominican Republic. Yeah, in the World Baseball Classic. And he made a couple of really nice defensive plays. You know, looked decent on that All-Star team. He was the one aberration on that stacked Dominican Republic team.
And Ricardo Nonita.
Well, it was one of the two. Both the Jays on that team. Well, there were good Jays on the team as well, but they stood out like a sore thumb.
Now, Sierra is... He could be a capable fourth outfielder in the majors. He has a great arm.
He does. And his
building isn't so bad.
It's been up and down from what I've seen. But, you know, I can live with it. And yeah. If we do lose Casper Wells to waivers, he immediately becomes the first call-up when we decide you can't play either of Wells or Rasmus or Lind.
Yeah.
Unless Anthony goes, which I don't see happening.
When I was down in Dunedin for spring training, there was a man on second, and the guy hits a fly ball. Sierra was playing right at the warning track. He's up against the wall, and he throws the guy out, tagging from second to third. One off. It was amazing.
Was it Billy Butler running?
It was not Billy Butler running.
Right, that's more impressive, though. So, we're going to take a quick break and be back with an interview with Harry Pavlidis talking about PitchFX and a bunch of interesting topics. So, yeah. And now joining us on the Blue Jays Plus podcast is Harry Pavlidis of Baseball Prospectus for some PitchFX analysis.
Hey guys.
How's it going, Harry?
Good. Happy Saturday.
Saturday is right. It would be a lot happier if the Jays had won this morning, but alas.
And the Cubs just finished up their loss, so I've had my daily supplement.
Join us in all that disappointment. Yes. So, why don't we jump in here? First question we have for you is about Ricky Romero and his fall from grace.
Yeah, he's... Go ahead, man.
Does pitch effect show us anything that has changed in his approach or his release point?
Well, it's really hard to see if he's changed anything mechanically through PitchFX, I mean, particularly with release points, because they're not really a precise thing in PitchFX. But approach-wise, there's definitely something, I think. He started throwing a lot of fastballs, and basically, it's a trend over a few years, and stopped throwing sliders, which was pretty strange. So, I mean, he really basically eliminated his slider almost completely, maybe only throwing it a couple times a game on average last year. So that's one thing. He kind of shortened up his, you know, repertoire and became actually predictable along the way, because he seems to throw very heavily fastballs and sinkers early in the count or behind, and will mix in his curve and you know, breaking off-speed pitch when he's ahead. So he's not really mixing up his pitches. He's not really, you know, throwing strikes. That's probably the biggest problem, is that even his fastball wasn't thrown for a high number of strikes, and none of his secondary pitches are thrown consistently in the strike zone, which makes things easier for hitters. So I think the inability to get ahead, the inability to miss bats, and the inability to get guys to chase stuff out of the zone just combined to make him, you know, obviously less than marginal. So there could be something mechanical behind that, but it's hard to say if it's something specific just looking at PitchFX.
That's great. Thanks a lot. Go ahead, Gideon.
Which stadium guns can't be trusted, and how is the Rogers Center gun specifically? We've noticed in the first week of the season, Brandon Morrow was touching 99, and Brett Cecil was touching 95, and then they go to Detroit, they go to Kansas City, and they're nowhere near those numbers. Is the Rogers gun a little hot?
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of funny that you mentioned Kansas City, because that's a very typically hot gun as well. Somebody else brought this up to me earlier. I had asked Dan Brooks about this, and he said it's roughly for the first month, which we're still in, it's about almost a mile and a half fast. It could be worse because of things like guys not having played in a lot of parks, particularly Toronto having played in Kansas City. That may be hiding it because Kansas City is always hot. So it could be a couple miles an hour. It could just be one, but it's something that we're going to try and sort out. But definitely something going on there. And as I mentioned, Kansas City's always been hot, a couple miles an hour. I think they've tried to fix it, but they really haven't gotten it straight, despite extensive efforts to fix it there. Toronto also sometimes has weird movement where the ball seems to be basically sinking, moving downward more, implying that the release points are too high in the system. So there could be some relationship between the speed and the movement issues. They're usually all kind of related, the way the camera systems work. But yeah, if you're seeing Morrow throwing 99 and then going to Detroit throwing less, if everybody's throwing even less in Kansas City, and if Kansas City's still hot, then we may end up saying later that it's closer to 2 miles an hour than a mile and a half hot right now in Toronto. So,
is that something you see change throughout the year, or once the gun's set for the year, it's sort of set?
Well, they're not a gun technically, just to be pedantic about it. It's, but no, once the systems are usually kind of. There's a couple different ways of calibrating. I mean, there's one of like the full installation process. One, there's a kind of a pretty full, you know, where you actually put markers on the field and recalibrate the whole system from the ground up. And I guess they've done that in Kansas City and it didn't get fixed. But the PitchFX operators also can run a couple different types of system registrations. So you can have parks change without a doubt. I mean, a month is not is way too big of a window. It can change game to game. It can more typically change between homestands, and I've even seen, you know, a few years ago things would change within a game where a system would be out of line all of a sudden. Now these things don't happen as much anymore, but there's no doubt that parks tend to drift and move around. So to the alignment, kind of part of it's the alignment as well, how much the ball moves and which way it moves. So like I said, there's a problem in Toronto. It's, I think, the opposite problem in Kansas City, where everything seems to be, you know, rising, as it were, but not, you know, not dropping as much as it should. And then you have places like Houston and Tampa, where everything is off a few inches, like, you know, almost a half a foot to the right. So everything shows more movement towards the catcher's throwing side, than it should. So those things don't seem to change much, you know, day to day or year to year, but, you know, they do occasionally look different from time to time.
Last Saturday, and at least once during this week, we saw an Ari Dickey pitch get classified as an EPIS pitch, which I know Vicente Padilla threw a couple times as well, but what gets things classified as an EPIS, and, yeah, well, why is that happening? Because I didn't notice an especially different pitch from Dickey on those instances.
Yeah, I mean, the EFIS, like you said, mentioned Padilla, that's right. I mean, the EFIS pitch was added to Major League Baseball's system for Padilla. And I don't even know if that's right to call that an EFIS pitch. So in my pitch tagging scheme, things would, that would be called a slow curve. So, it, you know, I don't try to get too cute with the tags. And in Dickey's case, it's not a curveball. It's not an EFIS. It's a slow knuckleball. So the way the PitchFX system, the way they do their tagging, and part of this is why I do my own tags post hoc, is because of this parts of problems like this, is they have to account for, you know, they baseline things off what they know the pitcher throws. And they have training data behind the systems that kind of like work with what their baseline knowledge of the pitcher, and they train their neural nets and say, okay, this pitcher throws this stuff, and this is how you identify it. Now, a guy with a knuckleball is going to be very difficult, period. But why did they have him throw an EFIS pitch when he doesn't throw such a pitch? It's because the system has to at some point allow for guys to throw a new pitch, so it can't exclude any other pitch in their system from being thrown. So it has to kind of allow for the possibility that Dickey or anybody may throw an EFIS. And if one of his slow knuckleballs looks really like an EFIS pitch, their system will spit out that tag. So it's just not right. It's erroneous. But it's just part of doing things real time, the way they do it.
And that's something that in your system will be manually changed after the
Oh, yeah. Everything gets re-tagged, yeah. So you won't see that tag in my output.
Good.
Cool. Field FX, like, what's the current status? When's each? When can we expect it data be publicly available? And yeah,
I would say approximately never. I think every major league team will have it within 2 years, but I don't think it's going to be made public. I don't think we're going to see something like that with PitchFX. You know how that's public again. I'd be happy to be wrong. I'll be pleasantly surprised. but I don't think it will be. I mean, for example, all the major league teams get hit FX and command FX. We don't get that. That comes from the same camera systems as pitch FX. So there's, you know, with the exception of command, they actually use their center field camera, which is part of pitch FX to begin with. But anyways, they don't share that information. So I would think we're more likely than not to see field FX, say, behind the scenes and not see it, unfortunately.
What is command FX? I've never heard of that before.
Because it's not publicly shown. They let out a little bit for study for one of their conferences. They basically try and measure the distance the pitcher missed the catcher's original target by.
Oh, okay.
It's fraught with difficulty. The information is not as useful, perhaps, as it was hoped and designed to be, but it's you know, better than not having anything. But it's actually a pretty hard problem to say what was the catcher's target. So that's where you get into some tricky problems. But there's still some it's still there. So all the major league teams get it for all their games, and of course there's all the minor league team systems that the teams installed as well, where there's pitch FX, which of course isn't public either because it's paid for by the teams directly in all their systems. So it's all out there. And there's a few field FX systems out there, too. It's going to be more widespread, but again, even as these things get more widespread, it's not being done public anymore. It's a very happy accident of history, I think, that Pitch FX was public, so I don't think we'll see it.
What's the rationale for not releasing it publicly? It seems like something that would increase fan interest to a certain degree, or, you know, public analysis.
Well, I think the latter point is the one that's material, is that there's the analysis. And I think that's one of the reasons PitchFX got good, is because so many people hammered on it, were able to publicly, you know, vet the information. And, it, you know, there's competitive systems, but like TrackMan, and they don't have it, let their stuff get publicly vetted. So they haven't, like, benefited from that crowdsourcing of product refinement that PitchFX gets. I think at this point, though, SportVision as a company is a different kind of company. So, for one, they're not totally dependent on Major League Baseball for establishing a sales channel to these teams. They're selling directly. Mm-hmm. Two, they've actually have some analysts, you know, in house, like a guy named Grant Goldbeck, who you guys may have known from Beyond the Box a few years ago. And he's worked for a couple of Major League teams, and he worked for SportVision. Now he's back. So they do have like analysis in house now. So there's not as much of a need to say, gee, we had this information with no idea what to do with it and put it out there. And same thing with Major League Baseball Advanced Media. They've grown, too. They're not the same company they were 6 years ago. So things have just changed to where the unlikely circumstances where something like that would be publicly available for a business like baseball, which is very, you know, wants to be private about its information systems. You know, again, it was really a happy accident. It was pretty nice that it happened. But, you know, these guys are basically saying this is our information, it's proprietary, and they don't want it just to be out there in the public. Now, from my point of view, it should be. You know, I think there's definitely teams getting more or less out of pitch FX analysis just to take just that, even though it's publicly available. It doesn't completely level the playing field, just improves it. But just because that's the way we think from a research and analysis point of view, doesn't mean that's the right way for baseball teams and data, you know, system makers like that, like SportVision, doesn't mean it's right for their business. So it's
up to them.
Yeah. In the end of the day. Yeah, absolutely.
It's unfortunate.
Absolutely. As for your pitcher profiles, when will they be updated?
So the ones on BP,
yes.
Yeah. Those actually, we just turned on 2013.
Oh, wonderful.
Just like 2 days ago, I think. So you should be able to, you know, check that out now.
When I wrote that question, they weren't. So always good.
Okay. No, you're actually, yeah, it was literally like within the last 2-3 days. So, like, since you emailed me these questions, I think.
We talked about Ari Dickey's knuckleball being classified as an EFIS sometimes. So which pitches are most commonly classified incorrectly, and what are the processes used to improve the classifications?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, like, for me, the way I work post-hoc, it's always where the pitches around the margins, you know, which is a fastball, which is a sinker, some guys, which is their slider, which is their curve. So anything like that, cutter sliders, even cutter fastball, depending on the pitcher, can be difficult to tell apart. It gets pretty hard with guys. I think Brandon Lee is a good example. It can get really difficult to tell his splitter from his slider. What happens when you have a guy who throws two off-speed pitches at the same speed, and since the splitter doesn't really tail, it kind of tumbles, and a slider can maybe sort of back up a little bit, they may get almost indistinguishable. And if it's a relief pitcher who doesn't throw 10 each in a game, where you can get eventually get like a kind of a cluster, a pattern, then, you know, it can be really, really difficult to classify. So any type of reliever who has that type of mix, any pitcher like who throws sliders and cutters, like Ryan Dempster can be difficult because he throws kind of a mush of sinkers, fastballs, cutters, and sliders and splitters. So he can be look like a cloud. Greg Maddux was a cloud of pitches, by the way. He was, which is like a tribute to how his stuff moved. But you know, the one Dickey's a good example. It's hard to tell when you have a knuckleball or when he's throwing those other pitches. Like, good luck finding his changeup. Even I have a really hard time being confident in identifying his changeup. So, and the way they, you know, I improve my stuff just over time, just review and research. For BAM, it's, you know, for their system, the real time stuff, it's better training data and, you know, better, just basically better inputs. You know, when the more information they have, and the more, you know, things they do, they, it's kind of the same thing I'm doing, but they try to apply it to the real-time systems to improve them. But at a certain level, some guys are just really difficult to tell, you know, which pitch is which, unless it's a good situation. So,
I assume that's more difficult for rookies with less information?
Yeah, well, definitely. It always is. The newer guy, the harder it is. And younger pitchers in particular, they tend to be, you know, be either inconsistent, right, just through their development process or through changing what they're doing. Their pitches can start looking different. Like some guys, what their slider and their curveball is can be very confusing because they may have one breaking pitch 1 year and two separate breaking pitches the next year. And the first year was a curveball, the next year was a slider and a curveball. But the slider kind of looks like a curve, and you can end up with some really weird looking pitch tags year to year. So there's kind of that. But, you know, with definitely having Pitch FX in the spring training parks in Arizona, and in, you know, so you get you know, a pretty good set of data from spring training, and you also get the Arizona Fall League, and we get a little dabble in the futures games. You know, in the summertime, there's that one game that by an All-Star weekend that we get data from, and that's helped over the past few years in making pitchers less unique. We get to see guys more, and I'm fortunate because of my work for some clubs, I get to see the minor league data too. So when guys come to the major leagues, I may already be really familiar with them. And then I can suddenly start talking about what they throw. So I think there was an example of that tonight when Hiram Burgos was pitching. I've always kind of liked his stuff just from seeing what he did in the minor league. So it's kind of cool to see him in the majors. And even though he actually made his debut on Pitch FX, the World Baseball Classic, which is another great source for pitcher debuts. So, but yeah, in my line of work, I get to cheat and look ahead.
did we have pitch effects in all of the World Baseball Classic games, like in Japan as well?
No, definitely not. Just the ones that came here in the big parks here.
Do they have anything like that in Japan?
You know, I've seen stuff in Japan, and like MPB Tracker that Patrick Newman has, his stuff is they give you speed, but they don't give you movement, and they give you basically what is an eyeball tag. So they're basically taking, I think, radar guns and pitch charts and publishing them as if they were Pitch FX. Korea, definitely, their league has it for sure. The data is not publicly available, but they definitely installed it and have Pitch FX running out there. There's Pitch FX and TrackMan systems all over amateur baseball. So there's college teams that use it. So it's all over the place.
How expensive is it to install?
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. Right. Probably really expensive.
So as pitchers tire during the games, I'd imagine that things like a slider would flatten out or the fastball is going to decrease in speed. Does that create additional problems in classifying the pitches?
Yeah, it definitely does for some pitchers more than others. I don't think the movement is so much of an issue. Things flattening out. I think flattening out things really maybe manifestation more of like location. than anything else. And the same pitch can look deeper just because it's lower in the zone. So, because you don't see, I've never been able to really pick out movement from tiring, but you can definitely see guys' fastball speed declining or all their speeds declining across a game sometimes. I mean, Verlander is a freak where he actually speeds up at the end. Jeff Samardzija does it too, but not many guys do that. Then you have guys like Ted Lilly, who will start out the game throwing their fastball like, 81. up to like 87, when he's really hot. But that will really screw up the real-time classifications. And it will screw me up, too, because I end up having to go down to an inning level for some of these guys to deal with their speed changing throughout the game. Because sometimes it's not just the tiring and their fastball can suddenly slide into changeup land. It's weird situations where, okay, first pitch of an inning sometimes just to get me over. Then there's when a guy's bunting, it's anything to a pitcher, 3-0 counts. I mean, there's all sorts of strange situations where guys just take a lot off the baseball. And those aren't changeups. So some guy may throw 92, he may have an 85-mile-an-hour fastball. That doesn't mean he's tired. It just means that he was throwing a get-me-over to the pitcher who's bunting, an 0-0 count. So there's really sometimes you can get really confused. So the danger is if they don't throw a bunch of changeups and you don't see that bleeding into each other of speeds, then they won't get divided out. So it's possible for a guy to hide a changeup. This is why relief pitchers are really difficult, because if some of them come into a game really slow really hot, like normal, but then they throw a second inning, sometimes their velocity can drop way off in that second inning. And it can be extremely confusing if you just look at the game as a game. So yes, post hoc, it messes me up sometimes. It's definitely a problem when you look at the real-time tags that they provide. And the other thing is when it's cold, guys don't throw as hard.
Yeah, I saw that in Detroit with Morrow whenever that was last week.
Yeah, and Johnson.
Yeah, so when the weather's cold, you lose velocity. Some guys more than others. Some guys adapt to it, I guess, better than others, apparently. But you have to deal with that. And then sometimes there's just weird things where the system is – I think Cleveland was miscalibrated, so everything was being marked a changeup for Ubaldo Jimenez or something. It was just because he was not throwing very well, the system was kind of not right, and it just combined to just making everything into changeups, apparently. So,
Ubaldo Jimenez wasn't throwing well? I'm stunned.
Yes, I know. I'm shy. It was that one game.
Exactly.
Regarding Steve Dalibar, his slider looks much different this year. Have you noticed anything that's changed, or?
You guys tell me, what's so different about it?
He's throwing it more, and he's not getting hit out of the ballpark.
Okay, well, I'll agree with those points. That's really the one thing he is throwing it. I mean, it's like three times as much now. There may be maybe a little bit more depth to it this year. Like I just said, with relief pitchers in particular, it's hard to really get a peg on these things. And he doesn't throw it often, even though he's throwing it more. It's still, I think, 12%. So that's still not a lot. He's throwing, I think, it just to righties and not very much to lefties at all, if at all. So it's hard to say with any reliever's third pitch, in particular Dalibar's, this early, if there's really anything different about it. Yeah, he's throwing it more. I have a suspicion it may be getting a little more, sink, a little more drop on it. But what's for sure, he's not getting clobbered on it.
Yeah, because if you looked at his home run rate last year on it, it was something like 80% of his home runs were on that slider. So it was a concern when I saw it ticking up in his usage rate.
Well, let's see. I don't know if I agree with that. Nah.
Nope.
That's no way. Home runs were... Oh, Dan took that off. Darn, I can't count them. Basically, his home runs on fly balls and line drive rate, 20% on his fastball and 17% on his slider last year. So, considering only threw four. How many home runs did he give up last year?
I can't recall.
It'd be really hard to give up 80% or whatever.
Oh, I was exaggerating.
Yeah, okay, but I'm just saying it would be really difficult. It probably just seems like it. Definitely home, and that's a good point about home run rates. Those tend to fluctuate wildly, even with starting pitchers.
Yeah, so. His was such a concern because he was giving up so many home runs in Seattle. It was one of my concerns when we traded for him, because when you're giving up that many home runs in Safeco, you know, leads to concerns. But
well, he seems more comfortable with slider now, you know, so maybe that's a sign of it being better, just the fact that he's throwing it more. Maybe just that, because he'll know, or catchers and pitching coaches will know if it's a better pitch or not. So the fact he's throwing it more, maybe. But yeah, the home runs, he really didn't miss bats with it, like in a scary.
That was more the concern.
Like, wow. Like missing like one out of six, and again, super small sample because he didn't throw it much, but one out of six swings were a whiff, and that's basically half of what you would expect. So.
And after his trade, after the trade, he seemed to junk it entirely. So, you know, maybe he's.
Yeah, and towards the end of the year, he basically was just, you know, it was weird. It definitely trickled away. But now it's back, and we'll see if it lasts. You know.
So finally, I'm wondering which pitchers from the past you were wondering we would have the PitchFX data for, because, you know, lots of these guys are mysteries.
Like if we could have PitchFX in like when I was a kid, I can tell you it's actually pretty easy. It's like, who would I want to see magically on PitchFX? Like Dwight Gooden, because he's incredible curveball. It's one of probably one of the best curveballs I've ever seen. So at the same token, you want to see Bert Blyleven, and then you have to think about Sandy Koufax.
He's my guy. And then
mine moves to Nolan Ryan. I'd love to see what type of, you know, action his fastball had relative to the standard fastballs of today. Steve Carlton would be the slider I would want to see. I would want to see what his slider was. Because, I mean, the guy, he's basically the best slider I ever saw. J.R. Richard also was absolutely devastating. Power slider, fastball combination. But Carlton's had, like, this nasty movement on it that was incredible. So if we can go back in time and have these the 1970s and 80s pitch FX, that would be great.
I was going even further back, and I really want to know Walter Johnson and Bob Feller's fastball velocity, because you hear the rumors of them, you know, blowing guys away, and, you know.
Yeah, and I would want to get all the way back to what was the guy's name? He never made it to the major. Steve Dalkowski.
Steve Dalkowski? Yes.
Yeah, he never made it to the majors, but he threw like 105 in the minors, had like thick Coke bottle glasses. And
yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, he basically, the Nuke Lelouch is the inspiration for that character in Bull Durham. Not a happier ending, though. No, the movie was definitely a better ending. Let's see, who else? There was another ridiculously fast guy.
Who was the guy who couldn't hit the plate either?
Akil?
what the hell's his name? The guy with incredibly improbable walk rate. We were talking about him last week. Anyway.
Yeah, but so, I mean, it would be amazing to go back and see things like the really old, like, screwballs, like a car, like a, was it Hubbard?
Or Valenzuela.
In the Giants, like his screwball. Oh, then Fernando Valenzuela, that would be awesome. See, his screwball was amazing. So it'd be so cool to be able to compare pitchers' movements over time like that. But for now, let's have to look at old video and imagine if we think we know what we're talking about. And by the way, people ask me all the time if you can get this type of stuff off of a single camera, old TV views.
Yeah.
And the answer is always like, no, they would not have built these pitch FX systems so you could do that. And so just that simple answer doesn't, you know, satisfy, which is fine, which is good if you're really intellectually curious. You're like, no, but there's got to be a way. There isn't. Yeah, I mean, the physics of it is not as simple as people think. You're dealing with the frame rates of a camera. And, you know, there's a reason why there's two cameras that are very carefully aligned to get even close to accurate data today. And it's just, so if somebody says, can you do it off just the old TV so we can get the stuff? I've seen the old video of, you know, Sandy Koufax pitching. Like, no.
That's all I have. You got anything else, Gideon?
Nope.
Well, thank you very much, Harry. Wonderful for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for coming on.
No, I appreciate it. It's fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll be back in just a minute. And welcome back after that wonderful interview with the lovely Harry Pavlidis, who was great. And we're going to go into a bit of a different topic. On Monday, as many of you know, Boston was hit with a bomb during the Boston Marathon on Patriots Day. And I'm not so much going to talk about the actual incident, which was obviously terrible. I'm going to talk about some of the reactions that I saw towards a number of beat writers, Jay's beat writers, and many others. I saw a bunch of people basically saying, how can you talk about sports in something as serious as this? And as far as I'm concerned, those people don't have a clue. Because these are people who, in the middle of the day, are at their jobs, following along on Twitter, and telling these broadcasters or journalists to essentially stop doing their jobs, while all these people are still at work doing their jobs. If you had a problem with these people continuing to report on news and do various things, why aren't you leaving your job at that very time? If it's so tragic, you know, these people still have their jobs to do. They're being paid by their employers to report on sports and, you know, tell us news. So it really upset me because just idiots. Any thoughts? I think you largely agree with me on this.
Yeah, I definitely do. I only have one tweet up here that I could see, but somebody tweeted Wilner, dude, Boston has been attacked, after he just reported about Lori coming back in the next few days. You're at race, won't need surgery. Batista's out. Wells was DFA'd. All that stuff. And then he says, it has, and I feel terrible for them, but I still have to do my job.
Yeah. And
that was not the only one. There were plenty of people saying, how can the Jays beat reporters do their job in a situation like this? We don't care about baseball right now. It's their job.
And it's not just, this isn't just a Jays problem. I saw this with Canucks beat reporters. I saw it with numerous national guys as well. And frankly, you know, if these, I hesitate to call them terrorists, but whatever you want to call them, if these people are stopping us from doing our lives, that's the goal of these attacks. Well, maybe not in this case, but let's not get into that. You know, this shouldn't stop us from living our lives. And sports during a time like that is what I'm looking for to escape. At the same time that I'm following along with this diligently, I stayed up till like 5 in the morning on Thursday following it along. And it's interesting, absolutely. But at the same time, I want to know if Brett Laurie's coming back. The Boston stuff doesn't affect me. I can't have any impact on it from my house miles and miles away in a different country. And just, you know, I found it very upsetting.
Yeah. It's like, well, I don't really remember, but apparently after 9/11, sports is what brought everybody together. So like,
absolutely, it did. I mean, the reaction of Boston to these attacks in New York were very inspiring. And as a wrestling fan, the same thing when I turned on Raw that morning or that night, it was a distraction away from the insanity that was going on in the world.
Exactly. So to tell Jay's reporters and any reporters outside of Boston, which Boston still had to do their job and report that the game was being canceled and such.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous to not...
I also saw people saying that, how can the Jays play on a day like this? Well, you know, what's going on in Toronto doesn't have any impact. The attendance was still very solid. It's just completely clueless. And you'll note that we're coming in tonight with the song, Jonathan Richman's song, Twilight in Boston. We are not using Sweet Caroline because it's a terrible song, regardless of the connection to Boston. It's a great song by, I would say, Boston's greatest musician. So, you know, we're all obviously thinking of Boston at this time. But at the same time, I've seen people saying that, you know, everyone's a Boston fan at this point. I gotta say, I'm not a Boston fan. I have sympathy for the people in Boston, but I still have as much dislike for a team that employs Dustin Pedroia as I did before these attacks. Yeah, it doesn't change my opinion. I hate the Red Sox.
As do I.
Yeah. So, with that, we will look ahead to the week that the Blue Jays have coming up. After the Yankees game, which will have been tomorrow, when you're listening to this, we have Jay Happ on the mound in Baltimore, in our first trip to Baltimore of the year, against Chris Tillman. R.A. Dickey against Miguel Gonzalez. And then Brandon Morrow against nobody.
And nobody's supposed to be a really good pitcher.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any idea who that is going to be starting?
Hold on, let me check, I guess.
I'm not saying myself. Nova Tillman. I guess it's going to be... I don't know. I assume it's going to be a call-up.
Do they not have anybody on the roster?
I'm struggling to find out here. Give me a second.
Checking the depth chart.
In advance.
After Gonzalez, they have Jake Arrieta. Is he injured? Or
Jake Arrieta, no. He's projected to start... 2 days later. Maybe they're pushing him back. We might get a call up for that game, which
would be amazing.
Could be Dylan Bundy, which would be interesting. Anyway, so that's to be determined on Wednesday. Then the Jays head to Boston, or Boston comes to town. Sorry, no. We head to New York, where Mark Burley will face Hiroki Kuroda. Josh
same
Johnson.
Same pitching matchups as the series, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Johnson versus Nova, and then Happ versus Sabathia, and followed presumably by Grosjean today. So that would be Burley and...
Burley started.
It'll be Burley Pettit. It'll be Burley Pettit on
Pettit.
Sunday. Dickey Pettit. Yeah, Dickey Pettit. So, as we discussed earlier in the show, this is a very critical time for the Jays because they have nothing but... AL East matchups, so we gotta start creating some hay because we could be buried if we continue our losing ways.
Yes, hopefully by the time everybody's listening to this, we just came off of a nice 20-0 beatdown of the Yankees.
Yeah, because Ivan Nova sucks, and Johnson looked great, so hopefully he can continue that on Sunday.
Yeah, I love when I get to see Johnson 2 days in a row, or 2 games in a row.
Yeah, it's exciting.
He looked awesome on Tuesday. Hopefully it's the same tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully the bullpen doesn't blow it like they did on Tuesday. So I think that's that. You got anything else?
Nope.
Nope. So we will be back next week, hopefully with another interview. And yeah, that's it. Go Jays, go.
When it's twilight in Boston, that's something I know about. Cause I've spent many walks, lonely walks, in the twilight. All through Boston and those suburbs. Right now I'm imagining the public gardens. The public gardens by where the swan boats are. And by the entrance that goes up to Beacon Street. Walking up Beacon Street through the back bay there, a few clouds heading for Kenmore Square. When it's twilight in Boston, taking a left, going by the Fenway, by the marshland part. the little memorial by the Victory Gardens. One of my favorite parts of town, those little plots of land. And it's getting darker, mosquitoes are coming out now. When it's twilight in Boston, headed for the river way, headed for the Jamaica way now. Yeah, time for adventure now. Twilight in Boston. When it's twilight in Boston. Time for adventure.